I told Megan to.
Well, welcome everybody to the March 30th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a long list today. We're going to start out with a study. We have to get a report on the highway cost allocation study. And James, do you need any introduction before Mazen takes it away?
I don't think so. Mazen?
How are you?
I'm good.
Members of Business and Transportation. Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. I think we bring you here a number of studies. First, the highway cost allocation study, and then a couple of the issue papers that we do with that. I'm going to get away from the witness stand here and give it to the state economist. He is, by statute, the office that is conducting the study, and he will take you. So Mark McMillan from the state economist office, and that will probably give a lot better use of our time.
Okay. Mark's going to hand it to.
We do a couple of handoffs, so please bear with us. I'm Mark McMillan, state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, joined today by Professor Don Negri from Willamette University and Carl Batten from Echo Northwest, who they are the consultant who performs the study for us. We're in front of you today, as we do every biennium, as a part of the highway cost allocation study. We have a constitutional requirement to determine whether or not our fee system for trucks and cars are fair. We tax the cars through the gas tax primarily and trucks through the weight mile tax. And every 2 years, we see, given the mix of construction activities that the state is spending on, whether or not those costs are shared in a fair, equitable way. So we're getting pretty good at this. This has been a constitutional requirement here in Oregon for going on 20 years now, and so we've got our methodology down to the point where we have other states that are really looking to replicate it. For us right now, the results, the bottom line this biennium is that we have very stable results, that we are still very close to equitable in terms of the fees that we charge right now. Given the mix, they didn't move a lot, and they're very close to what we would consider fair within reasonable margin of error. So this group, or our study review team that I chair, would recommend no need to change the rates to ensure fairness, and if you do put through a larger transportation package, it will be pretty close if we don't, you know, given what we do with overall revenue.
You have the votes?
I don't think that's a responsibility.
Thank you. So we've been able to, since we have this study that's so developed here and we have such wonderful input from our stakeholders, we're kind of in a different place than other states. Other states are really starting to try to do these cost studies. Why? Because they know the current system of highway finance is really broken and isn't going to last over the extended horizon with less driving among the population and more fuel efficient and alternative fuel vehicles and the like. So everyone's looking to the future. And what that means for this group is we've started to go into some of these alternative structures. We've started to think about this with our stakeholders and what some of these what the equity implications of some of these would be. So that's all I have prepared. I was going to pass along to Professor Negri, who will talk a little bit about this study review team and the process. We'll give you then the base study results with Carl, and then get on to some of these more interesting things if time allows.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Negri. I'm professor of economics across the street at Willamette University. I've been asked to talk a little bit about the process and introduce the other two issue papers that we're going to talk about today. So in terms of the process, I have served on 5 study review teams, including the most recent. The study review team that reviews the contractor's analysis is made up of a diverse set of stakeholders, including the state economist, interested citizens, independent experts, ODOT administrators and staff, academics like myself, and advocates for constituencies that have a significant stake in the outcome. The SRT scrutinizes every step of the process, including the model, model assumptions, the data, issue papers, and results. We also designate for the contractor the issue papers. We provide questions, analysis, questions of the analysis, and suggest alternative approaches. The outcome of this broad-based scrutiny is a process that has integrity and produces an analysis and set of recommendations that I would characterize as objective.
Go ahead, Carl.
Tis yours.
This is Oregon's 19th study. The first study was...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Carl Batten from Echo Northwest. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this study is Oregon's 19th study. The first study was completed in 1937, and since 1999, as Mark mentioned, we've been doing them every 2 years and recommending adjustment to the user fee rates if necessary. The question that we ask when we do these studies is, are the share of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of costs? And to answer that question, we calculate what we call equity ratios, which is the ratio of the share of revenue to the share of costs. So, for example, cars or light vehicles, we look at the share of total revenue paid by cars compared to the as a proportion of all revenue paid by all vehicles, and we look at the share of costs imposed by cars as a proportion of costs imposed by all vehicles. And if that ratio comes out to 1.0, then we say that there is perfect equity and things are as good as they can be.
And how do you define light vehicles?
It's vehicles that are 10,000 pounds and under, based on the Oregon statutes for registration.
So that would be a car, and how big a truck would that include?
It includes the heaviest of SUVs and pickup trucks.
Okay.
All the ones that can use a regular license plate. Okay. If the equity ratio comes out to more than 1.0, that means that that weight class is paying more than their fair share, and if it's less, that means they're paying less. Some notes about the way we do it in Oregon. The what we call the costs are the budgeted expenditures over the upcoming biennium. So we're looking at what we expect the equity to be in the upcoming biennium. We include the expenditures of federal funds because they are interchangeable with the expenditure of state funds in many cases. For example, a project that would be allocated heavily toward trucks might be funded mostly by federal funds, freeing up state funds to be spent on something that would be allocated more heavily to cars, and or vice versa. So to capture all the possibilities and make those particular funding decisions less important in the results, we'd pool all the money, including the expenditures by local governments of the state funds. They get their share of the highway fund from the gas tax and the weight mile tax, and the expenditures by local governments of federal funds and some of their own source funds. The own source funds that we do not include are certain property tax and SDC revenues that are dedicated to particular purposes and are not interchangeable with the state funds. The results this time around were an equity ratio of 0.9974 for light vehicles and 1.0047 for heavy vehicles. And as Mark mentioned, that's well within the margin of error and as close to 1.0 as it's ever been. We therefore don't recommend adjusting user fee rates in the upcoming biennium. And if there is a transportation funding package and new user fees need to be calculated, the highway cost allocation model is available for MASN to use to help design rates that will continue to be equitable.
Okay. I am going to introduce the first issue paper, which is the Efficient Fee Demonstration Project issue paper. The Efficient Fee Demonstration Project develops a roadmap for how Oregon might develop a demonstration program to transition from current highway funding mechanisms to an efficient fee instrument. In principle, efficient fees charges each vehicle for the cost it imposes for each mile of travel. Let me briefly explain why this is a superior alternative to the current unsustainable funding mechanism. The principles on which funding of Oregon roads is based is cost responsibility, fairness, and equity. Cost responsibility is the cornerstone of the biennial highway cost allocation study and means road users should pay for the costs they impose on the system. Recent trends in vehicle fuel efficiency, reduced automobile travel, and alternative fuel vehicles jeopardizes the funding for Oregon roads and violates the principle on which Oregon finances its highway system. The combined impact of these trends severs the financial link between road use and gas taxes. Why consider the efficient fee? In short, because it saves money in that it uses existing infrastructure more efficiently, and because it is fair in that it is based on the principle of cost responsibility. Not only is the current system developing inequity, it also does not account for the system cost associated with congestion. When a car or truck enters the congested road, it imposes a cost on all the vehicles in the stream. Since the price of entering the crowded system is not covered by the is not conveyed to the driver of the vehicle, the price is essentially zero and the demand for road capacity exceeds the supply. The cost in lost time and delayed business deliveries can be significant. We pay for this lost time even if the congestion does not materialize. For example, uncertain about the traffic conditions, I leave my house 30 minutes early to ensure that I make a flight at PDX. If there's congestion, I sit in traffic more confident that I make the flight. If the traffic is light, I spend 30 minutes marveling at the new carpet. Either way, uncertainty associated with congestion cost me a half hour for every trip. Congestion also prompts the state to build capacity, while the revenue from the users of that capacity are not the ones necessarily covering the expansion cost. Under the current system, part of the cost of the expanded capacity may be borne by those who do not benefit from that expansion or those who live in other regions of the state. That is inconsistent with the principle of equity on which our system is built. The efficient fee charges each vehicle for the cost it imposes on the system. Thus, a well-designed and implemented variable fee system would use existing resources more efficiently, reduce the need for expanded capacity, and give countless years of time back to Oregonians. Indeed, there are significant challenges to overcome before an efficient fee system can be technically or politically implemented, but the variable fee system is innovative, efficient, cost savings, and fair, and worthy of continued study.
Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Welcome to Transportation Conehead Land. You know, I'm joking, but I think it's important that you know that there is somebody in this state thinking about the future, and I don't mean the near future. Something like this is going to be some time away, but it's important that we start thinking about it and looking at the obstacles and doing those kinds of things. One of the things that is most attractive from the efficient fee system to me and my members is that the congestion charge also sets aside money for expansion of the system when the roads reach they're so congested you can't move. So it's much like a business that when they depreciate an asset, if they'll put that money aside, when the asset's worn out, they've got money to replace it. It's the same concept here, and that's very attractive. Right now, as you know, we pay as we go. And if something's worn out, we've got to have new money in order to fix it. And that's not a very efficient way of doing things. Some of you may recall that former Senator Starr used to say, give me a tolling system in Portland and I will solve the congestion problem like that. that's sort of an extreme example. But what this does is it makes the most efficient use of the existing infrastructure. So, for example, today you've got folks that will jump on the freeway, and then at the next exit or the one after that, they jump off. What this would do is price freeways higher than local streets. So those people making local trips would be encouraged to use the local streets and leave the freeway for the through traffic. That's what we mean when we talk about the efficient use of all of the infrastructure.
So how would that be implemented?
Well, when the Echo Northwest did the study in Seattle, and they basically had a device sitting on the dashboard of the vehicle, and it told the folks how much they were being charged depending on the time of day that they were using the facility and how congested it was. So it gave them an immediate price signal, and they could then make a decision whether they wanted to be on the most expensive road or on the least expensive road.
And so that actually you did it in Seattle?
And there was a demonstration project. Well, Carl's right here.
Mr. Chair. yes, it was almost 10 years ago now, and it was an experiment with over 500 vehicles traveling around Seattle with pricing on all of the freeways and principal arterials.
Was it real?
It was
That's
real.
Actually
it,
what they
it was
paid?
Real in the sense that all of the participants were given an endowment of money based on their behavior before the experiment started, and then during the experiment, that endowment was decremented as they drove around, and if they drove around in exactly the same behavior as before the experiment started, they would end up with about $75 in their account, and that was theirs to keep. If they changed their behavior, they would end up with more than that. So it was real.
Hmm. And what did you find?
We'll get there in a minute. We found some significant benefits.
Mr. Chair.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is going quite a ways back, but we talked about equity between the trucks and the vehicles, light vehicles. The question I have is, if you're talking equity, it seems like there's a lot of inequity within the light vehicle range itself. You have electric cars that aren't paying very much. You got hybrids that aren't paying very much.
Studded tires.
I have a gas guzzler that seems to pay more than his fair share, and so I'm just kind of curious if you looked into that discrepancy within itself, because the ratios are fine, but it seems like electric cars and hybrids, and as you said, the mileage keeps getting better and better, but we're still hitting the roads the same amount. So did you look into that, and what's your suggestion?
That was our other study.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, we looked into that in the prior study, the 2013 study, and did an issue paper on that issue. We found that that there are some significant differences in the equity ratios for subclasses of the light vehicle class, as you would expect. And there also are some differences between the equity ratios within subclasses of the heavy vehicles as well.
So to correct that discrepancy, it seems like we would be looking at registration fees. I mean, it's obviously you're not going to get a gas mileage out of an electric car. What sort of things are we looking at to take care of that problem?
Well, when you look at registration fees, it's a flat fee, and so it almost exacerbates the problem. What's really attractive to some folks about the VMT is it does address those issues, and it does provide equity within the light vehicle class.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add one thing. The efficient fee is equivalent to a time of day for electricity pricing, which I believe you're quite familiar with. So this is the road equivalent.
So we've been talking about efficient fees in the highway cost allocation study for nearly 15 years because it occurred to several people years ago that the ideal way to do highway cost allocation would be to imagine that every vehicle was paying exactly what it should be, given where it was driving, when it was driving, and the characteristics of the vehicle and the road it was driving on. And if that were the case, then you could add up the fees paid by each class of vehicles, and that would be the amount that each class of vehicles should pay. So we made an attempt at applying that method of highway cost allocation to determine if the classes were paying their fair share, first in 2001 and again in 2011. And one conclusion that comes out of that is that if efficient fees really were charged, there would be no need to do highway cost allocation anymore, because the system would automatically be as fair as it could be. And ODOT has been doing pilot studies related to road pricing, including Senate Bill 801 from the prior session. So what we looked at this time was how could a demonstration project for efficient fees be implemented in Oregon, and how could it fit in and tag along with what ODOT is already getting underway. So as Don mentioned, efficient fees charge for the wear and tear that a vehicle imposes. They charge for the cost of building new capacity to serve congestion. They recover the cost of administering the system, and they may also include costs such as greenhouse gases or pollution. They improve fairness by recovering the costs from the exact vehicles that are imposing the costs, and they've raised the right amount of money to sustainably fund transportation maintenance and investment. As Don described, the efficient fees for capacity are based on the amount of congestion that is being experienced in a corridor, and they raise the right amount of money to improve the capacity of the corridor. In the experiment in the Seattle area that we talked about a moment ago, the findings from that study were extrapolated to estimate what would happen if the efficient fees were charged throughout the Puget Sound region. And the conclusion was that the net benefits would exceed $28 billion a year. And it also, with only about 500 cars driving around providing this information, it still provided pretty good maps that the traffic engineers agreed were showing where the congestion relief was needed in the region. To demonstrate how efficient fees could work in Oregon, we recommend building on what ODOT is doing under Senate Bill 801. That's getting underway now in 2017. It's probably a good time to start talking about how you could build on the success of that. And we recommend developing a clear message that explains why a pilot project is useful, to include local governments and MPOs in the planning, to secure the authorization and funding, and to have clear expectations about the results. One thing we've learned from the success of the Seattle experiment and from the relative lack of success in some other experiments around the country is that that you really need to have clear expectations for what you want coming out of the demonstration, what you want it to accomplish. And there's a wide range of things that could be measured in a demonstration project. You can look at how driver behavior changes. You can test the technical and operational systems. You can look at how privacy is safeguarded. And you can gain an understanding of how it promotes fairness.
Okay. Okay, I've been asked to introduce yet the third paper. And that is on a carbon tax paper. As I prepared for this testimony, I could not help but wonder if the warm winter, diminished snowpack, and its consequent summer water shortages, and several years of drought in the southern part of the state were portents of the type of future we can expect under climate change. Obviously, I do not know that those weather conditions are climate change related, but those are exactly the climate changes that scientists have predicted for Oregon. Drought, warm winter have inflicted significant costs, especially on southern Oregon farmers and snow-dependent businesses. The carbon tax issue paper investigates the impact on Oregon of a carbon tax applied to fuels based on their carbon content. In this issue paper, the evidence from the analysis conducted by the Northwest Economic Research Center indicates that a carbon tax is not necessarily associated with lower economic output. In fact, this research shows that the strategic use of revenues from a carbon tax can lead to a net increase in employment and output. I will let the authors provide details.
For the record, I'm Jeff Renfro with the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University. Do you want to advance me?
Oh, sure.
Thanks. So just as a note, the research I'm going to present today came out of the much larger carbon tax study that we did and we published in December of last year that came out of SB 306. So everything I'm going to show you assumes a full implementation of a carbon tax. So we're applying the carbon tax to fossil fuels combusted in Oregon and electricity that was generated outside of the state but imported for Oregon consumption. We assume that the revenues are used to do a variety of things, including cutting corporate and personal income taxes, offsetting existing transportation-related taxes and fees, targeted investment, low-income support, and a host of other options. So if you want to... Oh, thanks. So just as general background, if we're thinking about a $1 per ton carbon tax, that translates to about a 1 cent per gallon increase in the price of gas. So if we're talking about a $30 per ton carbon tax, that's about, you would expect a 29 cent or so increase for a gallon of gas. There's really significant revenue potential associated with this. If we have a carbon tax of $30 per ton, we would expect to generate about $1.5 billion annually. If we ramp that up to $100 per ton, we'd expect to generate about $3.5 billion a year. Earlier in our process, we spoke with the Legislative Council, who talked to us about the constitutional requirements associated with applying a tax on transportation fuels. So based on their advice, we think that if you apply the carbon tax to gasoline, then that revenue has to go to the highway fund. Depending on a variety of factors, including the year you're considering, the price you're considering, the method you use to send the revenue back into the economy, that's between 41 and 51% of the revenue. So I'm not going to spend much time on this, partly because we're short on time, but this is a schematic that shows how our different models fit together. And the reason I'm showing this is to stress that we started with Oregon-specific models. Our sort of baseline for the Oregon economy matches what people expect to happen here in Oregon. Our energy information matches perfectly with the Department of Energy's expectations about price and emissions going into the future. So we put a lot of effort into making sure that this analysis is Oregon-specific. So our first set of results... our first set of results shows petroleum fuel demanded in Oregon relative to our expected baseline. So in Oregon, petroleum is basically used for transportation. So this is mostly effect on demand for transportation fuels. If we look at the red line, the second one down, that's our expected decrease below the baseline for a carbon tax that starts at $10 per ton, increases by $5 per ton per year until it hits a cap of $30 per ton. This is similar to what British Columbia has implemented. And then we go all the way down to $150 per ton down on the bottom, which would exceed the highest carbon prices we see anywhere in the world. But we wanted to present a range. So as you can see, there's pretty significant drop in demand for petroleum if this tax is implemented. And one thing to stress is when we look at the full economic impacts associated with a carbon tax, we can have small positive or small negative impacts relative to our expected baseline. But when we look at the demand for fossil fuels, it's pretty stable. So really, no matter what you use the revenue for, we expect the decrease in the demand for petroleum to look roughly like this.
So just to be clear, so the top blue line there, at $10, that's $10 a ton, so that would be 10 cents a gallon, roughly?
Senator Beyer, yes. So then in our analysis, we broke Oregon into six different geographic regions. So this is looking at the same results, but broken out by region. So the thing I want to draw your attention to is the purple line on the bottom represents the Portland metropolitan area. So really consistently across all of our scenarios, we see the biggest reduction in demand for really all fossil fuels in Portland Metro. And that happens for two main reasons. The first is when we look at industry-specific net impacts of the policy, the industries that we do see have a consistently negative outcome are really clustered in the Portland metropolitan area. So it's small relative to the size of their industry, but we do see consistently negative net impacts in Portland. We also expect people who live in a dense urban setting to have more options. So if the price of gasoline goes up, people in Portland have an easier time walking or taking the bus or riding a bike. So sort of built into the model based on historical reactions to price changes, we expect people in Portland to have a stronger reaction to those price changes. And then the last set of results I'll show you, this is a subset of the impact on total petroleum demand. So this is looking specifically at household motor gasoline demand. We see a very similar story. There's a range of prices there, but again, we see pretty significant reduction below our expected baseline based on implementing the carbon tax. If we're going to go to the last one. So just to sum up, so as economists, when we're using these mathematically driven models, we're always looking for something in the real world to sort of to make sure we're not just out in left field. So when we look at what our results say compared to what's actually happened in British Columbia, it actually matches really well. So British Columbia implemented a tax, a carbon tax, in 2008. There was also a global recession in 2008. So when you look at British Columbia and you look at gasoline demand in the rest of Canada, they both dropped together really quickly in 2008. And then as Canada started to recover and the economy started to improve in 2010, what we see is both economies start to go up to their normal levels. But in Canada, demand for gasoline goes back to its pre-recession level pretty quickly, whereas British Columbia, the demand stays at that low recession level. So it's too early to isolate the effect of the carbon tax in British Columbia. But what we can say is something is happening there that's sort of decoupling, or it's fundamentally changing the relationship between GDP and demand for gasoline. I already talked about the metro area. And then to go back to the constitutional requirements that would funnel the transportation revenues to the highway fund, one thing that we see, a big impact associated with that, is if there's a big increase in the amount of revenue being dedicated to constructing and maintaining highways around the state, that is in effect a public works project that's happening around the state. So what we see is the transportation sector in particular is an industry that benefits from that highway construction and maintenance project. So you would expect the trucking industry to have negative impacts associated with an increase in their price of gasoline, but what we actually see are small but consistently positive impacts associated with that increase in the construction economy here in the state. So with that, I'll to you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA, and our role in this is to raise a couple of caveats in the way we have philosophically approached taxation for transportation in Oregon. This goes in a line similar to the way the gas tax operates. And depending upon who you apply it to, this would be the equivalent if you applied it to trucks as moving from a weight mile tax to a diesel tax, in that this mechanism, in its general application, cannot capture the impact of weight on the system. It also suffers from the same essential challenges that were discussed earlier about the gas tax, where you have some winners and some losers based upon their fuel efficiency and their emissions. And it's a different direction than where we're going with the discussion around vehicle mile travel tax, where the goal of that approach is to try to approximate the actual cost of the vehicle on the road as it's operating. So that was a caveat that that at least we felt it was important, so that when you're comparing these things, you know what the gives and takes are. So the goal here is a little bit different. It's more of an environmental-sided goal, whereas the traditional method and moving to a vehicle mile travel tax is really trying to capture actual cost imposed upon the system. And so that's my role today.
So one way to read this is, as you would expect, as you increase the cost, the use goes down.
Senator Beyer, that's correct.
That's essentially it. And to the extent, and mostly the use would go down by those who have the flexibility not to use it. Light vehicles, most likely. Heavy vehicles probably will not change much because you're still delivering goods. So you are then having an effect in reducing capacity. You may create more capacity because you're taking demand out of it, but you're not necessarily generating funds. You may not need as much funds because you don't have as much construction to do, but you're going to get less. You may get less money from the system than you would otherwise. And to the extent that Craig's talking about, it may make the fairness equation, it may slant that a little bit. That's the issues with it. And you're adding, essentially what you're doing is you're pricing externalities, which we can argue about whether they're really there or not. Okay? You're up?
I'm just going to make a statement, and that is, if you're really interested in reducing carbon in the system, forest fires is the low-hanging fruit, not fossil fuels. It's not even close. And if we reduce forest fires by just a small amount, we would reduce a heck of a lot more carbon than your bloody tax is. Thank you. Statement.
I've never heard that speech before.
Yeah, I don't know.
Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Very interesting. Does that do it?
Thank you for your time. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Mazin, you have anything to add? Or?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you for once again taking your constitutional responsibility and executing it to the fullest. And I think the... one of the issues that I'd like to bring out, the system as it exists, obviously we examined it and we found it to be balanced. However, it is starting to have cracks, and some of the cracks is who's paying what and who's paying fairly and who continues, and these are the new visionary type of studies that we're trying to get in order to maintain that this system will continue doing this in the future. And that's what we appreciate you giving us the time to present to you today.
Well, it's probably fair to say that overall the constitutional requirement is the balance between heavy and light, and the system does a pretty good job of measuring that. It's somewhat determinant on whether we're funding something or not. I mean, that's a big factor in where you're going there. Doesn't do anything towards the things that Senator Gerard was raising about the conflict or the fairness between different types of light vehicles. We're still missing that.
Right.
And as we shift more towards more fuel-efficient vehicles, that will increase in its effect on the system.
And requirement for capacity and
right.
So on. Right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was very illuminating. Any questions before we move off of this, gentlemen? Seeing none, okay, we will. That really wasn't a public hearing, so we will move on then and open. We'll open a public hearing on SJR 16. James?
Mr. Chair, SJR 16 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to authorize use of motor vehicle-related revenue for infrastructure that reduces traffic burden of or pollution from motor vehicles on public roads in the state. Refers proposed amendment to people for their approval or rejection at next regular general election. There are no amendments, and there is no statement issued for revenue and no statement issued for fiscal.
Okay, so Mr. Howell and Mr. Smith, you asked for this hearing. Would you like to come up and start us off?
Thank you. Gentlemen, we've got a whole bunch of bills to go through, so if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Senator Beyer, Senator Girod, Floyd Smith. I'm a board member of the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, known as AORTA. I'm here to support SJR 16, which would broaden, with a vote of the Oregon electorate, the motor fuels tax in our Constitution. I will make one essential point here. From my perspective, this is important for the future of transportation in our state. As more and more younger people use cars less and less, they will be using and are now using transit, and this opens the door. This is a pathway to that future for the next generation of travelers. Thank you.
Senator Girod, my name is Jim Howell. I asked for this amendment. Basically, I want to make it very clear that this is not a tax amendment. This is a matter of choice. It allows you, the Legislative Assembly, the opportunity to use gas tax and motor vehicle fuel, fees in the most efficient way. Now, you will probably hear today some objections to this, that it's a raid on the gas tax and we need all the money we have for highways. What this does is allow you, the legislature, to, in the future, after this passes, hopefully by the vote, us, the voters, the opportunity to use other means to reduce the demand on the highway. We just heard a lot of talk about the problem with congestion during peak hours. Nothing was said about how to reduce that congestion by better use of public transportation. We know right now that in Portland, there's a couple freeways that would have to have another lane if we didn't have light rail. One would wonder what the congestion on I-5 coming between Portland and Salem if we had frequent coach service between the two cities. We don't. We don't because there hasn't been the funding to do that. This would allow you, the legislature, to determine if that's a good use of money. So you'll probably hear a lot of other reasons for this today, but I'll just focus on those two right now, and I'm glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? I have a big agenda to go through here. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Davis Arnold, Douglas Allen, Dan McFarland.
Good morning. My name is David Arnold.
Oh, sorry.
And that's quite all right. I am president of the Oregon Association of Rail and Transit Advocates, and as such, I live in the Grand. And so my perspective is from a person and representing people who live quite a distance from the transportation on this side of the state. I also did serve in the Oregon Department of Transportation Rail Division State Rail Plan project the last couple of years. One of the things that came out of that meeting was our need as a state to develop a really, truly state and regional transportation plan. And this was not only a group of people interested in passenger rail, but trucking, environment, freight, rail, and so on. And so it was a very good coalition. I support this personally, and I know that I represent people who do also support this resolution simply because we have inadequate, from my perspective, transportation sort resources over in Eastern Oregon. Our bus service is very poor. We lost our rail transportation, passenger rail transportation in 97. So, and Portland is becoming very important to people on the east side, and many of us think of La Grande as just being a little further out in the suburbs than some of you live. I myself have to come to Portland to do work a lot. I have to go to OHSU for another reason, and many people in Eastern Oregon do include college students because we have a university there, and I've had many of them tell me that if there were a train here or a better way to get here by bus, we would take it because we really prefer not to drive. And the other cohort of people, of course, are the older generation and the elderly, many of whom do not drive and have business and health reasons to come to Portland. And so I see this resolution as addressing some of the issues that the State Rail Plan Committee and our group have addressed in terms of just the need for funding in order to free up some revenue to go towards either improving existing surface infrastructures or adding to them. And I think I'll limit my comments to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
For the record, my name is Douglas R. Allen, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. I worked with Jim Howell to help develop the language of SJR 16, and I wanted to briefly cover what SJR 16 does and why we believe it is good policy and why Oregon voters will support it. I've submitted some written testimony that covers the history behind this amendment and why we chose the particular language that we did. And to sum that up, SJR 16 doesn't do anything by itself to change what motor vehicle taxes are collected or their amount or how they're distributed. And the gas tax will continue to be split between ODOT and Oregon's cities and counties unless a legislative body determines otherwise. We believe that the word surface transportation is a well-defined category, and it excludes marine and aviation, but does include elevated surface and underground rail and transit, as well as bicycle and pedestrian projects, and of course it includes roads. I've also submitted written material from the 2013 Oregon Values and Beliefs Study, which is part of the ongoing Values and Beliefs projects, and I think that that information shows that Oregonians would like a change in the restrictions of the sort that we put in SJR 16. And we were a little late out of the starting gate with this amendment, but when I went around to organizations asking for support, I was very pleased at how everybody said, well, this is something that we've needed for a long time, and now's the time. So we got support from 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Coalition for a Livable Future, Oregon Environmental Council, Upstream Public Health, Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, Bike Walk Vote, and of course the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, and also Metro Councilors Bob Stacey and Sam Chase endorsed this. And we think that our coalition of bicycle land use and transit supporters can easily raise the $500,000 to $1 million needed to advocate for this statewide ballot measure. And I think our coalition has thousands of members who contribute regularly to their organization. And we can put together an Oregon-friendly campaign on television, radio, and direct mail that will highlight Oregon's outstanding environmental and land use record and our state's commitment to transit, walking, and cycling. We think that with the threat of climate change and Oregon's driving less and less every year, the time is right to fight congestion by giving people options that free up our highways for freight. This is a valuable use of our gas taxes, viewed from any perspective. With that in mind, I think the money will come flowing in. And your support as Oregon's leaders will be an important part of our campaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Dan McFarling. I reside at 20585 Southwest Cheshire Court in Alloa. Congestion is not so much a problem to be solved as it is an inherent characteristic of over-reliance on a mode of transportation that is inherently inefficient in terms of land use. The energy plan published by the state of Oregon in 1989 clearly stated that until we modify the Constitution to allow motor vehicle revenues to be used for transportation solutions that will actually meet our transportation needs, we cannot begin to hope for effective transportation policy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Questions? Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I have in my district Pacific University, which has campuses in both Forest Grove and Hillsboro. And we have a lot of traffic on State Highway, we call TV Highway, that's created just because of that particular thing. The light rail system ends in Hillsboro, and 6 more miles would take a lot of traffic off of that TV Highway. I've been trying to get that 6 miles for years, and I would love to continue to try to get that 6 miles.
Chair, Senator Monroe.
I want to build that 6 miles, and I want to build 6 miles the other way to connect to Mount Hood Community College.
Thank you both. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we got Donald Leap and Jonathan Ostar. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chairman. Please. Well, for the record, my name is Donald Leap. I serve on the Public Transportation Advisory Committee at ODOT's request, PTAC, and I also serve on the Rail Advisory Committee, which reviews modal projects for Connect Oregon. Oregon hasn't done a good job because it's left money on the table. And our neighbors to the north in Washington State are the clear example of how that's happened. PREA legislation in 2010 offered two states 100% payment of projects for projects that they had already been able to do some research or work on. The term at the time was shovel ready or this type of thing. We all remember that from the news. Because Washington's Constitution allows its money to be used for looking into other transportation projects, the state of Washington had public transportation projects in the pipeline they could basically pull off the shelf. They received almost $800 million in 100% funds for particularly rail projects at the time. Oregon essentially had no rail projects because we didn't have any way to do that financially through ODOT. We got maybe about $10 million to fund a study. In other words, we didn't get a shovel-ready project that moved our transportation forward. We lost out. We left money on the table. Passing SJR 16 goes a long way to fix that kind of problem. I urge that we move this out of committee and onto the floor. And AORTA, I know, as an organization, is willing to get active and stand behind it and promote this. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Oster. I'm the director of an organization called OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. We're a civil rights organization, environmental justice organization, based in Portland Metro. We have a little bit of statewide reach through the Governor's Task Force on Environmental Justice, working with ODOT and other state agencies to implement best practices in daily operations that meet the needs of all residents. I think we all know that we have a transportation funding crisis here in Oregon. It's a lot of the work that this committee is doing this session and many previous sessions. Where that funding crisis is biggest is in transit service operations funding. Oregon does fairly well nationally in terms of contributing as a state to capital construction. We are in the top 10 states nationally in terms of our state contributions to building stuff. Where we do really poorly is in helping transit agencies run that service. And transit agencies, frankly, and smartly, don't want to expand the transportation system if they don't believe that they can consistently, sustainably run the service. They don't want service levels to have to go up and down and have to cut back. I think I could speak to you at length about the equity from a fairness perspective and an access to opportunity perspective of why we need to invest more in our public transit systems. I'm not going to do that today. I think where this committee seems to be focused is on revenue and on economic efficiency. And you just sat through a presentation on different revenue funding mechanisms. The assumptions of those funding mechanisms are that people in Portland Metro are going to reduce their carbon consumption. That is only based on whether we can provide the level of service that would give people a viable alternative. And right now, that's not the case. Ridership is actually decreasing in Portland Metro and TriMet relative to population growth. So we're losing a share of riders every year that population grows, and that's because of one predominant factor: a lack of service. And a lack of on-time performance, which is a function of service. And so while my organization actually works with people who are dependent upon public transit, first and foremost, and there's a growing movement locally of folks who care deeply about seeing public service be restored, I think really what we're after is that sweet spot. We want to do right by people who don't have other alternatives, but we actually also want to incentivize people to make smarter, more sustainable choices. And the only way we do that is with increasing service. And right now, the state of Oregon contributes less than 3% of overall statewide public transit operations costs. That's in the bottom 20% nationally. So we're simply not keeping pace. The average state nationally is 24%. And we're under 3%, 2.7%. So we need to do something in terms of making an investment in public transit operations, and SJR 16 would allow the legislature to go out and make those equitable investments and allocations. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next up, Michael Morrison and Ron Buell. Welcome, gentlemen. Whoever wants to start.
I'm holding up a copy of yesterday's Oregonian. Is this our new normal? It asks about the drought. A front page story, and inside, state water security gradually eroding, and Our drought here is nothing compared to what's happening in the country's southwest. Maybe some of you have driven by the Hoover Dam lately in a visit to Las Vegas like I did. And the Colorado River is incredibly low, and it supplies a lot of the water to Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Los Angeles. And maybe you've driven by Lake Shasta recently and noticed the puddles that are left of what used to be a lake. Undoubtedly, you're aware, as legislators, that Lloyd's of London is hesitating to continue the state's firefighting insurance at a cost anywhere near what we've been paying. In the last 2 years, we saw huge forest fires. You mentioned the forest fires. And the merchants of doubt, the AstroTurf organizations hired by coal and oil companies, have been quite successful in denying the greenhouse gas effect that's melting our Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets, that's causing serious mega drought in the U.S. Denying the fundamental physics, which scientists and climatologists say is a result of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere capturing the warmth there. The facts are that the internal combustion engine and its burning of diesel and gasoline on our highways is producing about 33% of this greenhouse gas effect. In Oregon, our business organizations and our largest daily newspapers are asking the Oregon State Legislature to build more highways to get rid of congestion. the bogus study that the groups put together says that increased population is going to cause more driving and make congestion just worse and worse.
Mr. Mule, could I interrupt you just for a second? I forgot to ask you to put your name on the record instead of the audio record.
Ron Buell.
Thank you.
1810 Northeast 70th Avenue, Portland.
Thank you. I apologize.
It's okay. So, actually, people in Oregon are driving less. And they're driving cars that use less gas. And that's why we're here asking you to keep the infrastructure we've built, the highways and the bridges we've built, well maintained so they serve our economy. I'm in total agreement that we need to earthquake-proof a number of our bridges, particularly between the coast, and that we need to do a better job of maintaining our highways. We, in 2011, we cut way back on the maintenance, the repaving of our highways, made significant cuts, and that just gets to be more expensive in the long run. But While we need to do that maintenance, trying to build ourselves out of congestion at this point in our history by building more lanes and widening existing highways doesn't work. It induces demand, the queuing theory means your new lanes and roads cause more driving, and when you fix a bottleneck, it just moves down the road. And so... We're here proposing SJR 16, which would fund mass transit and bikeways on highways where they reduce congestion and pick up on the trends that actually exist. When we were studying, Lee and I were involved in all the meetings, watching all the meetings on the Columbia River crossing over a six-year period, and we heard people say, well, there were going to be 12 to 16 hours of congestion at the bridge across the Columbia by 2030. And that's what Tom Hughes and Matt Garrett and others kept saying over and over again. When A.W. Smith did the study, the study came back and said, well, there has been no increase in congestion from 2001 at the bridge, 2001 to 2013, when they, at the end of 2013, they turned in that study, A.W. Smith turned in that study, no increase in congestion at the bridge. And I'm not saying that bridge isn't needed. It is. But there's a bridge that costs about $2 billion less that we could have built. And so what we're saying here is, let's be smart about getting people off the roads. Now, I mean, you look at the traffic coming across the bridge at rush hour when it is congested, and those are consumers. Those are people, commuters, I mean, people who are going to work. And it's not a high mix of trucks. The trucks stay off the roads at that hour because they can't move effectively and efficiently in the rush hour. And we need to have those consumers choose transit. We need to have them choose to bicycle when they can. And if you don't think the biking in the Portland area isn't going up dramatically, you haven't spent any time recently at the Hawthorne Bridge during rush hour. There's hundreds of people going across that thing. And so what we're saying here is, let's make it possible for Oregon to get rid of congestion by means other than building more capacity. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Michael Morrison. I reside at 639 Southeast Lynn Street in Portland. I'm here to urge this committee to move this measure to the floor. For a vote, I think that this resolution is about choice, and it also would provide the opportunity to find the best transportation solutions for each individual transportation need. If really that is a highway, then that's what we would continue to do. But there are many other options that you've heard about today. The fact that we in Oregon failed to receive a significant piece of the high-speed rail funds when they were dispersed by the Transportation Department simply because we couldn't provide matching funds. This would be a solution to that, but it would also reach out to all parts of the state. We could improve rural bus service, for example, and this is, again, an important lifeline to many of the areas of our state that are not being adequately served. That's the end of my remarks. I'll answer any questions if you have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Thank March. You. Next up is Jenny Dressler and, let's see, Craig Honeyman. Welcome.
Thank you. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jenny Dressler with the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I am here opposing SJR 16. It is Farm Bureau's policy that highway funds are used predominantly and primarily to fund highway maintenance and construction and bridge maintenance and construction. We are opposed to opening that up to provide money for bike paths or mass transit. Oregon agriculture depends on a strong transportation system to transport agricultural products and support a viable farm economy. Improving roads and bridges is our priority, and we would be opposed to opening this up for other projects and stretching those funds. Thank you
very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm going to testify in respectful opposition to SJR 16. Revenue for basic highway, road, and street maintenance is on the decline. Mm-hmm. Cities face a $300 million a year or more deficit in just managing their own street budgets. Some of us remain hopeful for a transportation package out of this session. So for all those reasons, we submit now is not the time to interject a major new policy issue, i.e. a vote on a constitutional amendment, or to divert revenues for other purposes. Not quite sure that there's clarity as to what SJR 16 actually means or specifically intends to accomplish, but it will open up a lot of discussion about interpretation of what constitutes appropriate expenditures from the State Highway Trust Fund. So in closing, the League prefers to keep our focus on resurrecting a 2015 statewide multimodal comprehensive transportation funding and policy package, and therefore we oppose SJR 16.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard earlier that the division of the funds would not change, that the cities and counties would continue to get the same share, and they would be able to use that however they wanted to. Do I misunderstand that?
The intent was just to open it up for use for any transportation purpose. I think that was the intent.
But it doesn't change the distribution amounts.
No. Nor does the current constitutional language. That's statutory. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Craig Campbell, John Rakowitz, and Bob Russell. Gentlemen, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I will try to be very brief today. Members of the Oregon Trucking Associations oppose this measure, and there's just a couple of reasons why. You've all seen the cliff chart that ODOT has been providing. We certainly don't have adequate funding for our road and highway and bridge system, and we don't think that it's wise to open that up for additional uses. The second thing that's attached to my testimony is a history of the constitutional amendments regarding the highway fund. The highway fund in our state was created in 1942. Since that time, there have been 7 ballot measures proposing to expand the use of the highway fund. All seven of those have been resoundingly defeated. And I certainly wouldn't expect that there would be a different result today. So that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Mr. Rakowitz.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. And I don't think it's a surprise we oppose SJR 16 for some of the same reasons that Mr. Russell just spoke to. I will add, there's probably not a time in this country's history, at least in the last few decades, that the stability of the State Highway Trust Fund it could be any more important, given the inability of the federal government to figure out when and how and if it's going to fund transportation. So we actually view the stability as a major feature of the Highway Trust Fund. And I guess I would add, we are contractors. A percentage of my members do build this, but the vast majority don't build highway projects of any kind. We are broadly and deeply in support of the integrity of the Highway Trust Fund as it currently exists in the Constitution, and that's because as an industry we can do no better than the economy. And transportation funding is so fundamental to the economy, we look at it and go, this is an industry-wide issue that we have to support. So again, we oppose SJR 16. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon-Idaho in opposition to the measure. Three arguments. The first is that we acknowledge that there is a need for additional funding for transit, rail, bike, ped. But instead of taking that out of the existing highway fund, we need to find a funding source and stream that is dedicated to those uses and is robust enough to take care of those needs. One of the greatest benefit we have is AAA in the discussion around transportation funding packages is that although the public by and large has a great difficulty in accepting any tax increase, at least we can argue to our members, you know that if you're going to pay this tax, that this tax is going to go to the purpose for which you were promised, which is highways and bridges. And the third comment I would make is that this presumes that there is some level of extra money available to our funding for highway and roads that can go somewhere else, and quite frankly, I would argue that funding level is deficient currently, and so this exacerbates that problem rather than helps solve it. And with that, I am willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Questions? Thank you very much. That is all I had signed up on SJR 16. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Mr. Mollis. She did. Opposed. Welcome, Mr. Mollis.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, John Mollis, representing the Oregon State Building Trades Council. I was in Portland in meetings this morning, so I just got here and wasn't able to sign up. So I apologize for that, and I appreciate you giving me a little bit of time. And just for time's sake, I would just like to weigh in and say that I'm in agreement with the previous panel. We would be opposed.
So that would mean you're opposed to the SJR?
That's correct.
Okay, just to be clear. Okay, any questions of John? CNN, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else wants to comment on this? Don't see any. So for today, we will close the public hearing on SJR 16. And let's see, what do we got? And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 138. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 138 removes the production limit of 5,000 barrels per year for brewery public house licensed selling malt beverages who distribute their product. We have three amendments here. We have a dash one amendment, allows for a brew pub to self-distribute any amount of malt beverage to any location owned by the same entity, permits brew pub to self-distribute any amount out of state, enables brew pub to self-distribute up to 7,500 barrels, changes the current limitation of production from production to distribution. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. The dash two amendment allows for brew pub to self-distribute any amount of malt beverage to any location owned by the same entity, permits brew pub to self-distribute any amount out of state, allows for up to 5,000 barrels of self-distribution starting January 1st, 2016, allows for self-distribution up to 10,000 barrels starting January 1st, 2018. And then the dash three allows for brewpub to self-distribute any amount of malt beverage to any location that is wholly owned by the same licensee or is owned by a wholly owned subsidiary of the same license, allows Brewpub Mini Calendar to sell at wholesale and distribute to licensees of the commission malt beverage produced by Brewpub licensee, if exclusive of any self-distributions described above. The Brewpub license distributed 5,000 barrels or less of malt beverages in the immediate previous year. No revenue statement, and there's no fiscal impact statement issued.
Mr. Marquis, believe you brought this to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing Cascade Brewing today. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your help in drafting some different sets of amendments. I've been talking with the folks who have been opposed to the legislation as drafted. I don't want to speak for the Romaines. I think he has signed up to speak after me, but I believe we have an agreement on the dash ones, which, as just described to you, would allow for the distribution of from a brew pub to any of their own locations. It would also allow you to export your beer out of the state. And then in addition to that, you could distribute up to 7,500 barrels per year by your self-distribution through yourself. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Markey? Don't see any. Thank you, Matt. Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm working with my daughter at the Romaine Group. We represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We had proposed in Senate Bill 138 the dash three amendments, which basically would say you could, number one, self-distribute to your own locations, the ones you wholly own, which is basically the McMenamin model. And the other was that you could distribute up to 5,000 barrels per year. Nobody even comes close to that amount in a brew pub, and going to 7,500 will basically be it won't affect anybody. It's really the practical effect between 5,000 and 7,500 is almost nothing, so we have no objection to the amendment, the dash one amendments.
Mr. Romaine, my assumption, I think, as you and I chatted about before, is that probably if anybody got close to those numbers, they're probably going to seek out a distributor anyway, because it's just that's generally not the business they're in.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. Really what happens in any kind of distribution model is once you get by past your own little home area, it's not economical to take product much further. You really want to pool it with a bunch of other people who are going out there, and that's the role of a distributor. So really where you find self-distribution is within the geographic area close to the particular brew pub. Now, please understand, a brewery itself, which is a totally different license, has no limit on the amount they can self-distribute. So somebody like Ninkasi Brewery in the Eugene area can self-distribute, and they do, to maybe a wider area, maybe not, but I doubt if they're even that close to the 5,000 barrels. Again, once you get off past a certain point, just naturally you're going to go to somebody who can do it much more economically than you can.
So, Mr. Monroe, Senator Monroe, excuse me.
Why is this bill needed at all?
Asking the wrong guy.
Oh, I had to come to an agreement. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, the part about the McMenamin issue is definitely needed for McMenamins to continue to deliver their own product, because they, at I believe one or two of their brew pubs, have gone either pushing up against the 5,000 barrel production issue or coming close to it, or maybe even gone beyond it. So it is really needed there. The other one, by changing it from production to distribution, you can actually track it. Right now, the OLCC doesn't track production in a brewery because, frankly, from our standpoint within this state, if you produce 100,000 barrels and ship 99,000 outside the state, we only collect tax on that 1,000. So that's where the records are kept. So changing it to production, or from production to distribution, makes logical sense. And then we got into a little.
Oh, excuse me. So it'll increase state revenue?
No, it will not increase state revenue. One iota. Why do these conversations always morph into a beer tax discussion?
I don't know.
Any other questions? So you're okay with the dash threes?
Well, I'm definitely okay with the dash threes.
Dash ones.
But
dash
ones.
Dash one was the
code. I would encourage.
Getting confused in my dashes.
But realistically,
doesn't matter.
It's really not going to make that big of a difference, practically speaking, in the world today, or even in the world for the next foreseeable future.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify on this? Looks like we have an agreement, so the chair will move the dash one. Close public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 138. I'm getting confused today, too much stuff. Then the chair moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 138. Discussion on that? Any opposition? Dash one. Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves. I'm getting happy with that thing. Chair moves Senate Bill 138
as amended
by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. No discussion. Is there any opposition?
I think I'll be a no.
Really?
Yeah. It doesn't raise taxes.
What has that got to do?
Let him carry it.
Fine. Senate Bill 138, as amended by the dash ones, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Senator Monroe in opposition. Closed on that.
Who's
we'll
carry.
Oh.
Here?
Senator Thompson wishes to carry. Okay. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 583. James.
I'll call. Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 583 allows brewery public house licensee to import malt beverages for which licensee controls brand, permits brewery public house licensee to hold off-premises sales license if they wholly own the off-premise sales licensee, or if the brewery public house licensee does not exercise control or participate in the business decision or influence the sales or purchase of the off-premise sales license to disadvantage a competitor's liquor brand, establishes nine-member Oregon Spirits Board to support Oregon distilled liquor industry, declares emergency effective on passage. We have three amendments here. The dash one amendment allows brew pub house licensee to hold directly or indirectly an interest in an off-premise sales licensee. The dash two deletes Oregon Spirits Board and Distilleries portions of the bill and maintains the brewery public house licensee portion. And dash three modifies reporting process to a quarterly basis for a person holding a direct shipper permit of wine or cider. There are no fiscal or revenue statements issued for all three of the amendments.
Can I ask a question?
None of them are issued?
None.
Can I ask a question, Steph?
Go ahead.
Does this in any way conflict with 138 that we just passed?
It does. Mr. Romaine. We can't move today anyway.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine with the Romaine Group, and I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And yes, the language currently in 583, even with all the different amendments, doesn't really take into account what you just did in 138. So there's a reason to put this off for a little bit, and I'll explain it. First of all, in addition to the concepts that your committee administrator was talking about, there is a dash four amendment. I don't know if it ever got to the committee or not. Okay. Which does other things. And basically what you're doing with this bill is using it as a vehicle to try and clear up some overlap of licenses out there. As we've gone around the last 10 years, 15 years with various licenses, we have things that overlap and don't make sense. They conflict with one another. You allow somebody to do this, but don't allow them to do that, but they can get a different license to do that. In addition, one of the problems we saw was with cider production. A brewery and a brew pub right now under current law has to get a winery license to produce cider. But frankly, why is the question? Why not be able to produce it under a brewery license or a brew pub license? There are other issues, and we're trying to work with some interested parties. One of the things that we found in the past was that a winery license was being issued to people who were not producing wine. So a few years ago, you passed a legislation that said you had to have a federal permit, basically, or to get a federal licensed warehouse to get a winery permit. The problem is that doesn't take care of the issue of somebody who might have that for another reason, like a brewery, but is not going to be producing wine, but will be using it to do other things like have a restaurant. Is that really where you want to go? Now, some of you have been around alcohol distribution laws and production laws for a long period of time and realize that sometimes the word arcane is used, but what you have to understand with this is you're dealing with a controlled substance that is potentially harmful. So you want to keep track of what's going on out there with the product. At the same time, you want to foster an economy that can grow and produce a great product as we have within the state of Oregon. But if you notice, we've done incremental changes. We have not done wholesale mass changes. We've done little changes, see how they work. If they work, we continue. If not, we can get rid of them. That's what we're saying with 583. Give us a little more time, another week, to kind of put some things together to present to you to say this is maybe a better way to sort of clean up the licenses a little bit. We'll work with the OLCC, and we'll try and get to a point where you have a reasonably logical licensing structure. The other thing that is in 583 right now, which is at least in the amendments that we were proposing, which I thought were being sent down here, in 583 is a brew pub within the state of Oregon basically contracts with somebody in another state to produce their product that and then imports it back to their brew pub. Well, that defeats the whole purpose of having a brew pub, which is to produce stuff right here. So those are things we want to make sure we cover, we don't open up the system too much, and we get a logical system.
Okay, Senator. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had, and maybe I misheard, but didn't someone say that we're trying to change the makeup of the board or the commission through one of the amendments?
One of the amendments, yeah.
Senator Gerard, in the original bill, there was the establishment of a 9-member Oregon Spirits Board, but then in the -2 amendments, it deletes the Oregon Spirits Board. This bill has three big components. Two of the components have mirror bills over on the House side. The House side seems to be the mechanism they're moving. These amendments remove those two big portions, leaving the Brewery Public House section, which Mr. Romain is working on.
The modified gun stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Gyrod. That's absolutely true. Basically, this was sort of an omnibus bill that came out of the interim study on privatization and trying to do a few things. And again, we're just trying to make it logical. We'll work with the OLCC. Hopefully, we'll have something very logical and realistic for you.
Okay. Other questions? Paul?
Don't leave. Is there anybody else who feels the need to testify on this day? Jesse, you're sitting on the edge.
I'm actively listening.
Actively listening, okay. Maybe you'll talk a little bit, actively talk with him, make sure that we have the right one. So I didn't have anybody else, so we're going to close the public hearing on 583, and we will bring it back in a week or so.
Yeah, be great.
The -4s, 5s, and 6.
We'll have -25 by then.
Thanks, Paul. We'll close on that. And we will open on Senate Bill 937. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 937 prohibits retail sale of granulated alcohol, allows sale of granulated alcohol at wholesale only for scientific, industrial, manufacturing, or other purposes approved by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. There is no amendment, and there is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact.
Okay, Paul, what'd you get me into here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association with the Romain Group. Mr. Chair, we got you into something good here.
Actually, it'll save us money.
This is going to save you some enforcement headaches, which is really every once in a while you're given the opportunity to maybe get a little bit ahead of a curve, and this is what's happened here. A few months ago, I believe, the feds approved the sale of granulated alcohol. And what that is it's basically powder in a pack, and you pour it into a liquid, and you stir it, and you have you take a non-alcoholic drink and make it into an alcoholic drink. Well, let your imagination run wild over what could be done with this particular product. What we've heard from the proponents say, it's lighter for airplane use. It's great for backpacking because you only don't have to take in other, you know, liquid and stuff like that. And that's all probably well and good. The problem is the potential here for ingesting the product by those who really shouldn't is great. In addition, the product, because it's in granular form, can be taken in other ways, like through the nose. So we are not really keen about this product being out there. It is a product that, you know, logically, if it was available for sale, it might come in through our clients. And we polled our clients, and they said they don't want it. So we think you have an opportunity to get ahead of the curve. We highly encourage you doing this. Other states have already jumped on the bandwagon here. We know Washington State passed something, I think, through one house. But it's moving, and other states have actually banned it. So
I think we would be the seventh or eighth state that would ban it since the feds did it.
And, again, it's nice to be able to present you with something where it's a good thing.
That I like.
That, and Senator Monroe likes. That's a very important thing.
Senator Monroe, did you have a question?
Yeah, are we going to get any extra money out of this?
Questions? Comments?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's not Paul. Now, OLCC must have a comment on this.
They don't like it.
At least your director did informally.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm not sure that I have too much to add to Mr. Romaine's testimony. This is a product that would need to be listed through the commission if it were available for sale in the state of Oregon. My understanding is that earlier this year, the makers applied for a listing and the OLCC declined to list the product. And we, of course, have no position on the bill, but I echo some of the sentiments
of my colleague. So the commission declined to list the product and sell it in Oregon, but you have no position on the bill.
We have no position on any bill for which we are not the sponsor. However, we did have some concerns about both the demand and the public safety considerations for this product. Felt that it needed real careful research and study before we were comfortable listing it through our liquor agents.
Fair to say we could watch a few other states and see what issues arise. There's no great demand for it.
Yes, Chair Beyer, that was essentially the commission's decision in declining to list.
Okay. Questions and staff? OLCC? Senator Monroe.
Well, just a comment. 21 years a high school teacher, I can imagine all kinds of problems with this product in the hands of teenagers. So I strongly support this bill.
They're not supposed to have it, Senator. And of course, we know they don't get their hands on alcohol.
They're not supposed to have a lot of things that they have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 937? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session. The chair moves Senate Bill 937 to the House, or excuse me, the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
I'd like to go into the House.
Just forget where we've been. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 937 goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Monroe wants to carry this one. All right. We'll close on 937, and we're down to, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 120.
ask a question on the floor. Are you doing more of that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 120 creates provisions for transportation projects to meet vehicle mobility standards adopted by the Oregon Transportation Commission and the Land Conservation and Development Commission. We have three amendments with Senate Bill 120. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that transportation facility means any physical facility that moves or assists in the movements of people or goods, enables city or county considering an amendment to a functional plan, comprehensive plan, or land use regulation that would impact a transportation facility proposed, transportation improvements located in another jurisdiction to mitigate the impact of the amendment on the facility, allows highway mobility targets established for highway corridors as a basis for proposing transportation improvements located in another city or county, requires the Department of Transportation and the Department of Land Conservation Development to jointly submit a report before September 30th, 2015, describing the above process, declares emergency effective on passage, no fiscal impact, no revenue impact on Dash 1. The Dash 2 adds the words significantly affect a transportation facility for clarity and planning processes. Rest of the amendment is the same as the Dash 1, no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. And then when the Dash 4 amendment clarifies that transportation facility means any physical facility that moves or assists in the movement of the people or goods, requires the Land Conservation and Development Commission to adopt or amend rules as necessary to allow a city or county to propose transportation improvements located outside of that city or county when the city or county is considering an amendment to a functional plan, comprehensive plan, or land use regulation, and the amendment would significantly affect a transportation facility within the city or county. The rest of the Dash 4 is the same as the Dash 1, and minus that the report be submitted by September 16th, 2015, declares emergency effective on passage, no fiscal impact and no revenue impact with that Dash 4 amendment.
Well, I have absolutely no one who's signed up for 120, so who wants to? Doug. Welcome, Mr. Riggs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. I had a PowerPoint that I showed the first time I was here, and I thought it might be helpful to take a look at one or two pages of that PowerPoint, so we'll get that spun up.
Don't think that's it.
I could talk about that as well.
Unless you wanted to cover carbon.
Yeah, I will say I think this is really, it's about the Dash 4s. The Dash 1, 2s, and 3s were an attempt to get everyone together. As you recall, we held a hearing on this way back about a month and a half ago, almost 2 months ago. So what we're talking about is the ability to be creative with transportation funding and planning. So we have a corridor here between, say, Lapine and Redmond, or Redmond and Madras, someplace like that, and there's a community in the middle. We have a development taking place inside of one city that brings jobs, economic development. Right now, we're allowed to mitigate the transportation impacts on the state highway because of the TPR changes that have been enacted in multiple places in the city, so we have a little bit of flexibility. But what's come up during the League of Cities conversations at the conferences between my mayors and mayors from the coast and the valley and up in the metropolitan area is, what if we want to be creative? You know, a job development in the north end of Redmond might attract people coming in from Madras and vice versa. Something in Lapine might attract people coming in from Sun River or Bend. So if we can establish a corridor along Highway 97 or Highway 99 or 101, let's try to be creative and maybe work with ODOT, work with the counties, and try to mitigate that impact on the corridor as a whole, maybe even speed traffic. So it's a long way of saying that this amendment would hopefully get us to this point. We had a hearing. DLCD came in and had some concerns. We met in the hall. We had a couple of meetings since that point in time. We've been crafting with LC to get the right language. We think the Dash 4s do it. Basically clarifies that DLCD and the LCDC can accept creative proposals on a voluntary basis from local communities that choose to band together to try to be creative in solving transportation issues. So we like the Dash 4 amendments, and we think they head us in the right direction, and we'd like to see them passed.
Okay. Questions? Senator Gerard?
Yeah, I just was thinking, I don't know if this impacts the private sector in the sense that, say, let me give you an example. Say Walmart went in to Redmond, and you know how they have to mitigate for traffic, but that mitigation benefits them because it's going to allow in and out of Walmart that much easier. It just seems to, does this in any way change that so the city can say, no, you're going to go to the north end and fix that traffic light up there where Walmart wouldn't benefit from the traffic light, the in and out that they would have.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, I don't think so. We don't change anything in the requirements that underlie the basic transportation planning rule. We're just simply saying that we could be a little more creative in the location in which we do that. So I think the requirements on a developer and or a city would still be the same. But it would give, you know, right now what we're faced with, and I'll give you an example, at the north end of Bend at Cooley Road, that's where the Juniper Ridge development was taking place, and that has the potential to create 5,000-7,000 jobs. At the time when the TPR was a big discussion point 4 or 5 years ago, all the transportation mitigation standards had to be implemented at that intersection right there. So the revision of the TPR allowed us to be a little more creative, and Bend was able to make some changes at this point in Bend and over here in Bend and back here in Bend. That helped. What we're saying is take the next step, and maybe we could four-lane a stretch between Madras and Redmond and speed transportation through that corridor. But I don't think that it would have any impact on either increasing or decreasing the requirements for systems development.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it would increase or decrease the amount that they would have to mitigate. But what I'm saying is the placement of that mitigation, if the city, again, says, look, we don't want the light to go on 395 or wherever it would be. We want the light to go up here, on which the developer wouldn't benefit from the mitigation. It seems like they should have some say into how that mitigation gets done, and not just the city. And that's my concern about this bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, I think I see what you're getting at, and I think most of the impacts we're talking about are from a potential development where you might have a fairly major change in the number of vehicles taking place on that intersection. And so it probably wouldn't be an existing Walmart, for instance, saying, you know, I might have 10 more cars. It might be the fact that Walmart has not yet come, or the fact
that
industrial company hasn't come. And so in that case, I think that the company that would want to locate would have a significant amount of say as well. So it's a choice. Like in Redmond, for instance, we passed a bill, Senate Bill 1544, out of this committee a couple years ago that allowed for fast-tracking some of the infrastructure developments for the Redmond Industrial Park. This might allow us to put the final piece of the puzzle together to bring in a job-creating development with, say, 300 jobs, or maybe in Hillsboro, where it wouldn't be there unless you could find the mitigation. And so this allows us to get to the mitigation.
Yeah, I'm all for the flexibility. Cities sometimes hold you for ransom, and I hate to say that, but it's true. And I can see this becoming an issue with some developer somewhere where the city really doesn't want the development, and they go, okay, well, you're on the hook for $2 million worth of improvements. Oh, by the way, you're not going to benefit from the improvements. We're going to do them out here.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, I see your point. I think in most cases what we are talking about is a less expensive, more creative way to meet the state guidelines that already exist. So, for instance, if Cooley Road would cost $130 million, but others would cost $20 million, that would be the alternative here. And I will say, just for the record, that my cities have been very supportive of job creation, economic developments, and but I'm sure in other parts of the state.
Let me tell you, there's a lot of no-growth cities out there. I happen to know a few in my district.
Yeah, in your district, you have no growth in your district.
Oh man, there's a lot of cities that absolutely don't want growth.
Further discussion or further questions of Doug? Seeing none. Thank you, Doug. Anybody else? No one else? All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 120. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 120. Looks like we have agreement from everybody, so we'll move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 120. Discussion on that? No discussion. Is there any opposition?
Go ahead.
I'm going to oppose. I might change my mind on the floor.
You going to oppose the amendment, or you going to wait for the bill?
I'm going to wait for the bill.
Okay, so no opposition to the amendment, so we'll... Well, I didn't need to do that. The Dash 4s are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 120, as amended by the Dash 4, to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Actually, I'm a yes. Hmm? I might change my mind on the floor and be a no, but I'll be a yes now.
Hey, is there any discussion on this? I understand your concern. I don't think so, but any discussion? There is none. Is there any opposition? Doesn't appear to be any. Senate Bill 120, as amended by the Dash 4s, is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation, and a chair will carry. So we'll close on 120. I think that's it for the day, James. Anything else? Committee, anything else for the good? We're adjourned. Anything else for the good? We're adjourned.